donation. You can break that down and become a sustainer at $20 a month. But this book talks about the beginning of her life and when she was out there in America, right here, and she was with the Black Panther Party. So, folks, this is right up there with Malcolm X and Maya Angelou when we talk about autobiographies. The foreword is by Angela Davis. $100 donation, Asada Shakur. Know about her. Know about the history. Barry Levine, The Spider, Inside the Criminal Web of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. This is the book that Donald Trump doesn't want you to know about. Be on the same page. Know what's going on. 818-985-5735. We only have a few seconds left. Get the Tom Hartman book. Go to the talk. And that's for a $120 donation. The book, the talk, everything. You can get a ticket, two tickets for $50 or one ticket for $30. Hey, whatever it takes to help this radio station. I'm Gary Baca. Thank you. And until next week, think outside the cage. Thank you, Mark Cofield.
All right. All right. See y'all next week.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. This week, we look at two remarkable stories that show how collective action can stop authoritarianism in its tracks. First, Professor Tom Alter, a tenured historian at Texas State University, joins us. He was fired on September 10th after speaking at an online revolutionary socialism conference. His remarks about organizing and defending workers were secretly and illegally recorded and then doctored by a self-described fascist influencer who launched an online smear campaign. This case is an example of what Alter calls the new McCarthyism sweeping higher education, but it's also a story of resistance. Students, colleagues, unions, professional and political organizations have rallied to his defense. We're going to discuss his case, the far-right assault on academic freedom, and why the fight for free speech must be collective, not individual. And then we turn to long-term Chicano activist and organizer Bill Gallegos, who joins us to talk about his article, Los Angeles Boots Out Trump's Troops, that is forthcoming in the Nation. In June, Trump sent more than 4,000 National Guard troops and 700 Marines into Los Angeles. His goal was to crush the city's immigrant defense movement and terrorize sanctuary communities. But LA didn't back down. Labor unions, immigrant organizations, faith leaders, artists, even business leaders formed a united front demanding the troops out. And they won. Bill Gallegos shows us how years of organizing, broad solidarity, and non-sectarian unity turned Trump's provocation into a stunning defeat for authoritarian power. Together, these two stories, one from the university and the other from the streets, show that solidarity works. When people organize, stand together, and refuse fear, even presidents and universities can be pushed back. Well, all this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Professor Tom Alter, a tenured historian at Texas State University, was fired on September 10th after he was accused of inciting violence in a video of him speaking at a socialism conference. His remarks about organizing and defending workers was secretly recorded and doctored by a self-described fascist influencer who launched an online smear campaign. Within days, Texas State President Kelly Dampaus fired Alter for, quote, jeopardizing the health and safety of the university community, violating both due process and First Amendment protections, not to mention the protections offered by tenure. Tom's case is emblematic of what he calls the new McCarthyism sweeping higher education, a far-right campaign of repression aimed at purging left and liberal educators. But it's also a story of resistance. A mass solidarity campaign followed his firing with students, unions, civil rights organizations, and colleagues rallying to his defense. On September 27th, a Texas judge ordered his reinstatement, which is pending the decision of the university president. Tom is joining us today to discuss the case, the far-right assault on academic freedom, and why the fight for free speech must be collective and not just individual. Tom, welcome to the show, and let me just properly introduce you. Tom Alter is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University and a member of Texas State Employees Union and the American University of University Professors, otherwise known as AAUP. He's the author of the book Toward a Cooperative Commonwealth, The Transplanted Roots of Farmer Labor Radicalism in Texas. What a great topic. Welcome to the show. Sorry what happened to you and solidarity to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Why don't we just begin by talking about the incident? Can you walk us through what happened, the actual talk, who you were speaking to, who recorded it, and what happened?
Thank you so much for having me on. And yes, this is a story of resistance. So I was invited to give a talk on September 7th as part of a revolutionary socialism conference, specifically to give a talk on building revolutionary organization today. It's kind of like a crisis on the left of organizing and trying to get us together to regroup to fight all the assaults that we are facing as working class people. So I was giving a historical overview as well as giving my views on different modes of organizing today. And this talk was given on Sunday, September 7th. It was an online conference. I was speaking from my home office via Zoom. On my own time, on a Sunday morning, not exactly prime time. I identified myself only as a member of a Socialist Horizon. That's a new, honestly small socialist organization. Also as a member of the Texas State Employees Union. That is the union that represents all state employees of the state of Texas. And that's how I identified myself. I did not identify myself in any capacity as a faculty member or employee of Texas State University. Now, unbeknownst to the conference organizers, a self-described fascist who describes herself also as an anti-communist cult leader. This person has horribly anti-Semitic views, saying that Jewish people chose to die in the Holocaust and Hitler went to heaven. And it's just a really icky rabbit hole.
Why don't we name her? I was going to ask you more about her, but her name is Karlyn Borisenka. So yes. Continue talking about it, and then I'll ask you who she is.
Yeah. And so she filmed the conference. She filmed my talk. At the end of my conference presentation, there was a question and answer period, and also myself and the other speaker gave our slight concluding remarks. And then the conference was going to break. And it was during the break that someone who knew me and knew that I taught at Texas State asked me a question of what it's like teaching at Texas State. So that's where my employment came up. It was during the break session of the conference. So this...
It was somebody in the audience asking you unrelated to the actual session?
Correct. We had gone to break. There were numerous sessions throughout the day. And rather than have everyone go offline for 10 minutes and then hope you get everyone back, it was an official break. I was getting ready to get up myself to get a glass of water and get ready for the next session. And someone happened to ask me a really, innocent question. Just he was curious about what it's like teaching at Texas State. And so I answered him. Well, then that became like the gotcha moment for the self-described fascist.
So that was a planted question, in other words.
I don't think the person who asked the question had any intention whatsoever of trying to out me or anything like that. It was a purely innocent question. The person's originally from Texas and was just asking questions about his home state. So we heard about the campaign the next day.
I was going to ask you next. How did you find out?
Yeah, there were some people that were familiar with this Borisenko character. She proclaims that she infiltrates conferences. Well, really, these are online conferences that are open to the public. So she's really not doing any infiltrating. What she's doing is recording them against the wishes of people that are participating in them. And then taking comments out of context. So she took a comment that I had. I was addressing different modes of organizing. So I was talking about like direct action anarchists and saying while their actions are laudable, because especially like Cop City, they're literally putting themselves on the line, putting their bodies on the line in this direct action organizing. And so then I was then asking the question, well, without organization, which often anarchists don't have like sound like organizational structures, I was asking, how does one expect to overthrow the U.S. government, the most bloodthirsty, profit-driven, mad organization in the history of the world? So I was asking the question, not making a statement calling for the overthrow of the U.S. government. So this wannabe media influencer, self-described fascist, took that and then started a campaign saying, here is a Texas State University professor calling for overthrowing the U.S. government. Heard about it, decided not to give it any air. It's ridiculous. I just kind of let it pass. It wasn't getting many views. Well, it seems to have been picked up enough where someone made a complaint to the Texas State University president, Kelly Dampus. He then just immediately went online and announced that I was immediately terminated for inciting violence and that I was a danger to the health and safety to the campus community. And I found out about it. I was at my son's soccer practice. I got a group text from local community activists. I'm involved in activism in my community here in San Marcos, Texas. And they wanted to have an emergency meeting for me. And I'm like, oh, no, don't worry about it. I know about the online fascists. We're just not going to give it any air. And they're like, no, look at this. You've been fired.
And was this, you know, because the conference was on a Saturday.
It was on a Sunday. Mine was
Sunday,
on a Sunday,
rather. Was this like during the work week that all of this happened?
This was a Wednesday night.
So continue, because in the Texas State Tribune, it says that once in this article about your case, that once you were fired by the president of the university, that the Texas State University system chancellor commended the firing.
Yes.
And this is before any due process, any discussion, you know, you were summarily fired.
Yeah, summarily fired. And like I said, I found out through the like everybody else, or actually other people found out before me that I was fired. I mean, when I went home, there was an email that had been sent at 5:11 Central Time to my personal email because I was immediately locked out of everything. My Texas State email was locked out. I haven't got access back to it yet. I've been locked out of my office on campus. Basically, the university president and hence the chancellor just capitulated to a self-described fascist with no due process. I mean, tenure, you can be fired if you have tenure, but there's a process to be followed. And it's a very strict process. And it's also state law in Texas. There was an anti-tenure bill that was passed in the state of Texas a couple of years ago. And it's anti-tenure in that universities should control tenure, not state legislatures. And so here the university president violated Texas state policy on tenure, broke state law, and violated federal constitutional rights.
Right. So this is all pretty horrific. And of course, it's not, you're not the only one.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about what tenure means and what it protects and why it came about and how it's violated here. Maybe we should do that first and then we'll move on to the other cases.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us, what does it mean? And how does it protect you, protect all of us in academia?
Yes.
You know, from precisely this kind of an assault.
Tenure is supposed, it's to give professors that have earned it. It's a 6-year process to get tenure. It's not just something that happens automatically. You show it through your contributions to the academic field that you're a part of. In my case, it was history. I've published articles and a book on my specialty, like agrarian radicalism and working class movements, and also through service to the university and good teaching record, which I had all of those things. And so then what tenure is, it allows you to pursue different historical research topics that may be controversial or maybe push boundaries. And it gives you the ability to pursue those subjects without being fired. Now, if you're not then fulfilling your research, kind of research requirements, not fulfilling your teaching responsibilities, not providing service to the university, basically kind of the grunt work that makes universities move and go, all those behind the scene things. If you're not doing that, then there's a process to remove someone from tenure. But I had met all those things. Now, you also have, as all Americans, you have free speech and you have protected speech that all Americans have. But then what tenure has, it's not, Texas is one of those employment at will states. where the management can like fire you immediately. But that's 10 years like a contract you have with the university. And so it isn't not an employee at will. I have a contract with the university through my tenure. And so they can't just summarily fire me. There has to be a process. And so that's what tenure does. It gives you kind of the academic freedom to pursue different topics that may be controversial without facing repercussions.
Your firing is part of a much larger attempt to transform higher education in this country, which, as we know, has been a fight forever, but it's been also protected for the longest time. But under the Biden administration, this repression began against Palestine solidarity activism, and that has reached professors, staff, and students. And then Trump has turned that incipient McCarthyism into something much more full-blown and an attempt to purge the universities, not just of left-wing and liberal professors, but to control the content of what is being taught. Maybe you could just say a little bit about what they're doing and why you think that's happening. And I just also wanted to refer to, there's a second professor fired in Texas. And every time, you know, you open up Facebook or anything else, there's a case of yet another one, either who is suspended or fired. It's fairly widespread.
Yeah, there was another shortly right, almost like days before myself, there was a Texas A&M University professor that was fired for teaching gender identity to an early childhood development education class. And one of the students did not like that, did not like hearing that there is a spectrum of gender. And so this professor was just trying to teach, kind of educate future educators, different types of children that they'll have in their classrooms. Well, a particular student didn't like this, and so that professor at Texas A&M was also fired. Right. And so this has been an ideological assault on higher education. Now, universities are kind of like classical liberal institutions, kind of like liberal meaning the classical definition. It's broad, means openness. One of the basic institutions of what should be a free and democratic society, that you can have open debate, discussion, learn from ideas, not that they're centers of indoctrination by any means, but just to learn different perspectives. And through that means students learn. They learn different perspectives. Sometimes it just reinforces their preconceived ideologies that they had. Other times it opens up to other ideas. And having people open up, exposed to different ideas, that's not always what the far right wants. So they're seeking to really control one of the basic institutions of a democratic society, which is a liberal arts university. And so if you erode and weaken liberal institutions, it's very dangerous, for it's eroding the basic foundations of a democratic society.
And I wondered if you thought that your case is precedent-setting in this case, that it's a precedent-setting for professors nationwide. And we're also seeing how far too many universities are complying in advance. This also speaks, I think, to the administrative reorganization of colleges and universities altogether. It used to be that those who ran the administration of a university came from the faculty, and now they hire people who have never been in the faculty, but who were trained as administrators, either as provosts, presidents, deans, whatever. But they've created this bureaucratic layer that all of us in academia know all too well. The more administrators they hire, the more admin we have to do. Most of it is time wasting. But I wanted to hear from you how you think that this case is precedent setting.
Yeah. As you mentioned, there are quite a few professors and academics under attack across the country. I mean, we've seen it at University of North Carolina. We've seen it at Rutgers, University of South Dakota. Where my case is different, and you say precedent setting, as in those other cases, there was some form of process. Now, often that process is flawed. It might have been predetermined from the beginning, but there was a process, and that's what tenure is supposed to have. Mine did not have that process. So that was completely unprecedented, as far as we know. I mean, just even talking with other academics who have followed this stuff, as far as we know, I mean, of course, there could be a case out there, so I'm not going to speak in an absolute, but as far as we know, mine is possibly the only case where someone, a tenured professor, has been fired without any process. Again, there's we know that tenured professors, especially you get back to the 1950s and the height of the original McCarthyism, a lot of tenured professors were let go. But it went through some process. It was usually like a kangaroo court or some kind of sham process, but it had that process. Mine had no process.
So let's continue on this vein of comparing, of seeing the historical parallels to this, because everybody's beginning to talk about the new McCarthyism. And there are those who went through the period and said, oh, no, this is nothing like that, you know, because that was a period of mass intimidation. But, of course, we're having to say that this is too. And when you combine it with the other aspects of the Trump assault on democratic rights, on the Constitution, on, you know, the detention and deportation of anyone who looks Latino or speaks Spanish or whatever, that it is all of a piece. And I wondered, you know, because you started to reference the earlier waves in McCarthyism, but there's also Texas adds to it its own anti-communist laws. Can you talk a little bit about that and looking at the lineage of repression and resistance in the state of Texas? Even, I guess this might reference your own research.
Yes, there's a long history of repression in Texas, sadly. There's a lot of great things about Texas. I like Texas, but Texas can be rather harsh at times. Going back to the early 1900s, Texas Socialist Party. It was the second largest socialist party in Texas, in the United States, after Oklahoma. Most people usually think of like Oklahoma and Texas being the largest state sections of the kind of the Eugene Debs era socialist party. And the Rebel newspaper at a little old Hallettsville, Texas, a little dinky town between Austin and Houston, had the third largest socialist newspaper in the country. And that was the first newspaper repressed by the Espionage Act and the mass censoring that was going on when the United States entered World War I. Jump ahead, you get ahead into the 1950s, and Texas legislature passed like an anti-communist act. We're saying that you could not be a member of the Communist Party. Like the governor was even trying to go as far as calling for the death penalty for someone being a member of the Communist Party. They didn't go that far. Yeah, but they ran, you cannot be a member of the Communist Party and hold like a government job or run for office. The Supreme Court cases eventually came in and corrected that. So there's a long history of repression in Texas. And today it's also tied to broader fights that are going on. At the time in the 1950s, it was tied to the civil rights movement. Today we see it being, with this repression that's going on in academia, we cannot separate it from, as you mentioned, the ICE raids and the attacks on immigrants that are going on and others that just fit the profile of ICE's profile and just literally kidnapping people off the streets. And so, yes, this is a multi-pronged attack on our democratic rights that just the academic front the academic aspect is just one front, but we are experiencing this on multiple fronts. Going back, you said, to the Biden administration, the attacks on Palestinian activists and free speech. So that's why I've had a lot of broad support attracted to my campaign, because people see it as an attack on democratic rights. And it's not just about, yes, there's my immediate person of getting my job back, but this would be a real blow to democratic rights unless we win this case. And that's why so many people have rallied around it.
Maybe we should talk about the response to your firing. On September 27th, a judge in Texas reinstated you, but it's pending a university decision. Can you talk about that within the context of the role of students, unions, the AAUP, DSA, all kinds of organizations? If you Google Tom Alter, the first thing you see are all of the declarations in solidarity with you against the actions of Texas. So tell our listeners a bit about that campaign.
Yeah, the outpouring of support, you could say even more immediate than my termination. I was fired on a Wednesday evening, and on the next Thursday morning, students at Texas State University were out protesting, and they protested for 5 school days straight. Immediately, my union came to my defense, the Texas State Employees Union, that's affiliated with the CWA nationally. They provided the ground game of kind of organizing. And then the American Association of University Professors provided a lot of the national connections and providing a lawyer for me, which is a key aspect, getting that lawyer.
This is what they do.
Yes, this is what they do. And so right. the unions came up. I'm a labor historian, so I'm part of the Labor and Working Class History Association. They moved immediately and issued a statement in my defense. And then it's been followed by just a plethora of other academic associations, the American Historical Association, the Organization of American Historians, the Alliance for Texas History. I mean, it goes on and on, these different organizations. So the academic world has spoken, the labor movement has spoken, the students have spoken, faculty have spoken. And we had a rally shortly, it's kind of a blur, where we had elected officials here in San Marcos representing from the city, county, and state level coming out to speak for freedom of speech and democratic rights, again, unions. And so the support has just been amazing. We've got like the academic world, the labor movement, students, the free speech advocates on our side.
University and also president. International solidarity, right?
International solidarity as well is international solidarity, trying to keep track of it all. I mean, there's Congress members of the Argentinian National Congress that have like chimed in with letters of support. So that has been the real positive of this. It's been a unifying moment on like the broad left, which we know the left kind of can be tend to fractured and got lots of infighting. And even my talk was critical of different parts of the left. So here my talk that was critical of different parts of the left has brought us all together. And so to me, that's a positive that we've all, this is broader. I mean, like the whole spectrum of the left, from like liberal to like socialist, have been brought together in defending this assaults on all of our rights. And so that's been great. A judge then ordered my reinstatement to back onto the payroll in order to get health care, but the university did not put me back in the classroom and then proceeded with charges against me to now then go through the process, which they didn't go through before. But in Texas, especially at Texas State University, it's deeply flawed. I mean, there's no like faculty, co-faculty governance. The university president basically has the final say. So I had a hearing with him on Monday, that would have been Monday, October 6th. And it was supposed to have had announcement by the end of the week, but that hasn't happened.
So let's just go over. So one thing is that you were suspended from teaching. Your classes have been, taken over by substitutes or?
Yes. I was teaching a couple classes. I was also a faculty advisor of a few student organizations, including the Young Democratic Socialists of America. I was their faculty advisor. They've been great. They've stepped up completely. And I'm also advising a number of graduate students as well on their master's thesis. And so it's been totally disruptive to those classrooms. But there's a lot of great faculty on the history department at Texas State, and they've stepped in, like really come together to look out for the students and take care of them. But it was rather disruptive, especially.
And
for
then
the,
in your own case, so you were reinstated by this judge, but that case is pending. But tell our listeners a little bit about where the case stands and what you think might be the outcome.
Yeah, where the case stands is I had a hearing then with the Texas State University president, Kelly Dampus, where I was then offered opportunity to present my side of the case, where I was like, no, I was not advocating for overthrowing the U.S. government. I was not engaging in partisan political activity, which means usually running for election, or if you're going to run for office, you have to request a leave from the university. I wasn't running for office. I was talking about a hypothetical revolutionary party in a hypothetical revolutionary situation. And so I was not engaging in those things. So he heard me out. I thought that the hearing went well, was asked good questions, but now we've been waiting close to a week and without any decision. So we're waiting to hear the outcome, which I'll be reinstated and be a victory for all those that defend free speech and democratic rights, or I could be terminated.
In which case there will also be a giant campaign.
There'll be a giant campaign, yes, because there's so many. I mean, it's got academic world is enraged about what's happened to me. I mean, labor unions. I mean, it just would be a giant campaign. So there's also a lawsuit that's pending. So that's hopefully the university president will come to senses on the side of democratic rights and I won't be terminated. But if they proceed with this, there's a lawsuit and much more importantly, a bigger, broader campaign for free speech, which even if I am, hopefully I am reinstated, the fight for free speech and democratic rights does not end.
That's the last thing I want to ask you, Tom Alter, because obviously we'll keep track of what's happening and we'll bring you back and find out.
Yeah.
But the question then is, like, what collective strategies do you see as important to defend, as you say, free speech, rebuild solidarity on campus? And what do you think? I think somewhere I read that you said use your rights or lose them.
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Just keep on using them. Like I said, I used my rights and then lost them. Used my free speech rights and then got fired for them. But we can't hide. We need to be upfront and organizing. And that's the only way I've gotten where I am so far with my campaign. It's because of the broad support. So I encourage people, join your union. Join the union. Join other political organizations that match which things that you hold dear to your heart. Organize. Get out there. I mean, contribute what you can. Now is the time to fight back. It's kind of like I said this. We learn about things from the past. We hold those up and we're like, wow, look at the great battles of the labor movement and fights that for civil rights. Well, history has been thrust upon us now. We're in one of those moments, whether we chose to or not. And so what we do now is important. And it's the fight didn't start with me. It doesn't end with me. It keeps on going for all of our rights until we're free and we truly have transformed society and we no longer have giant corporate universities or corporations controlling our daily lives.
Tom Alter, thank you so much for all of that. We wish you all the best in solidarity, of course. Tom is let's call him a suspended right now, associate professor of history at Texas State University, San Marcos. He's also a member of the Texas State Employees Union. That's something that every campus, in my own, long struggled to try to unionize. Private universities have a harder time. Yeah. But also he's a member of the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, as Tom said, which provides legal assistance. And then he's also the author of a book, which you should probably run out and buy. Maybe we'll talk about that at another point about agrarian radicalism. It's called Toward a Cooperative Commonwealth, The Transplanted Roots of Farmer Labor Radicalism in Texas. We wish you the best, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us today. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman and very pleased to have Bill Gallegos joining us to talk about an article that he's written that will be published in The Nation. It's called Los Angeles Boots Out Trump's Troops. In June, as we all know, Trump sent more than 4,000 National Guard troops and 700 Marines into Los Angeles without the consent of the governor or the mayor, claiming that the city was burning down. This seems to be his template remark. His goal was to crush the city's immigrant defense movement and to terrorize sanctuary communities. But Los Angeles did not back down. Unions, immigrant organizations, faith leaders, artists, even some business leaders formed a united front demanding troops out. And they won. Bill Gallegos shows how years of organizing, broad solidarity, and non-sectarian unity turned Trump's provocation into a stunning defeat for his attempt at authoritarian power. The piece is both analysis and movement report. It documents how LA, a multiracial, labor-anchored, immigrant-rich city, successfully pushed back Trump's 2025 deployment of the thousands of National Guard troops and hundreds of Marines sent to enforce ICE raids. Trump's intent was to make an example of LA after mass immigrant defense protests, but the strategy backfired spectacularly. And that's what we're going to talk about, how the combination of organized resistance and cross-class unity, I guess you'd call it, the city forced Trump to withdraw the troops. And it's a lesson, an example for other blue cities now under attack from the Trump administration. Well, let me introduce Bill properly. Bill Gallegos is a longtime Chicano activist. He's working on the Mexico Solidarity Project. He's the former executive director of Communities for a Better Environment, a California environmental justice organization, and he's a member of the editorial board of The Nation. So welcome to the program, Bill.
Thank you so much, Susie. I'm honored to be here.
And I'm honored to have you. Well, this article tells an incredible story. And that's a story that, you know, you say could be a template because L.A. was ground zero in Trump's effort to crush immigrant resistance and the people of L.A. pushing him back. You call it a lesson in how to build the United Front organization against authoritarianism. So let's start there. What made L.A. a target? How was it uniquely prepared to resist? And why do you think Trump picked L.A. for his first show of force?
Well, I think Los Angeles in many ways embodies everything that Trump and MAGA hate. So it's an overwhelming majority people of color community, and not just Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles, but the larger metropolitan area of 12 million people. It's at a time when our union movement has faced so many challenges and become weaker. It's a growing union movement here and a very powerful and influential union movement that has been unafraid. The Los Angeles County Federation of Labor closes its meetings with workshops on fighting fascism. So this is not a federation that's avoiding politics and the conflict that we're facing right now. It has a huge immigrant community. And it's just historically, you know, it was a part of Mexico. And it's often forgotten that the United States annexation of 58% of Mexico's northern territories enabled it to become the superpower that it is today. Otherwise, it would still be powerful, Italy or Germany. But it's a superpower because it has this enormous territory with the most fertile agricultural land in the world and enormous resources and all of that.
And good weather.
There's a history there, yeah. And it also was an area where there's been resistance from Jump Street to Trump and MAGA. It were bluer than blue, but not just blue, but progressive. Right. You know, a sanctuary city, a city that is not going to punish its LGBTQ community, is going to support them, including in our schools. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to shoot our trans children. So this was a city that embodied many of the things that this right-wing social movement has attacked in their efforts to destroy democracy and create white minority rule. So I think there was a thinking that if we invade and occupy, it will intimidate and really pretty much crush this opposition.
Well, you write in the piece that the LA Resistencia did not flinch. So maybe we could, of course, this broadcast first in Los Angeles, so people who are listening were probably participating in the protests against the ICE raids, which were ostensibly to go after criminals, but instead just went to workplaces and inside workplaces and outside workplaces, detaining.
And parks where children were playing.
They were prevented from going to schools, but they tried. That's so right. How would you describe the mood in the city when the troops rolled in?
Well, I think there was mixed emotions. So one of it is like, ain't no way, dude. You know, we are not going to back down. So in many ways, it ramped up the resistance. You know,
very
so
much.
People were, it was so creative. So if they were putting folks up in hotels, they ran them out of the hotels. You know, nobody else wanted to stay in the hotels because you had music going on all night and drums playing and everything. So it's an incredible, extensive resurgence of resistance. In January 6th, when they attacked and brutalized SEIU leader David Huerta, the unions came in full force. HERE, the hotel and restaurant employees, had already been there. SEIU had already been there. But now, the building trade, there was nobody that sat it out. The steel workers representing the refinery workers who started the original car wash organizing campaign in the city.
Maybe we should just remind the listeners what happened, because David Huerta was beaten and arrested. And that just seemed, as you said, to galvanize the movement. And then also, you just mentioned the carwasheros, which I interviewed Flor Rodriguez from the carwasheros movement about how ICE had raided, sometimes repeatedly, more than 57 car wash businesses across, you know, Los Angeles County. Right. And even Orange County, in how they just indiscriminately arrested not only the workers, but the customers and sometimes the owners and sometimes people just getting off the bus on the corner near there. So it was absolutely horrible. And I've said this over and over again, but small businesses like car washes are traditionally the backbone of the Republican Party. And here they're shutting them down.
That's right. That's right. And as you know, Susie, because you were there, this Washero movement started more than a decade ago. You were there at City Hall when it kind of launched that whole campaign from the steelworkers.
Right. Yeah.
So it has a real roots there. And so there was already an awareness among those workers of politics. and what was going on, and of course their lived experience. So it was also seen as an area that was vulnerable. You know, they think they can go into the schools and in scares intimidate families. And
the restaurants. So
they, you know, the Home Depots where the jornaleros, the day laborers were gathering. So they chose these different locations. But, you know, as they met resistance everywhere that they went, they started to do crazy things like sending mounted people on horseback into our parks where the children were playing. So that it became at once ludicrous and terrorizing. But no matter where they went, there were worker centers, immigrants' rights organizations, the faith community, unions, people from the suburbs.
And mutual aid, a lot of, you know, help.
But I had people from Topanga Canyon calling me saying, we want to distribute literature at the farmers markets in our community.
Wow.
And, you know, at a certain point, even the liberal and neoliberal democratic establishment just jumped in. The governor, our U.S. senators, our congressional delegation, our legislature, the mayors of not only the mayor of Los Angeles, but the Southeast Los Angeles city mayor, city council, school board, school superintendent. So you had this incredibly broad, what was in effect an anti-fascist united front. Right. And the interesting thing to me, Susie, was that, you know, how we usually snipe at each other and divide each other and attack each other. That didn't happen. There were major coalitions, some of which, you know, had more left presence and were, you know, somewhat more radical than the one that had been started by the County Federation of Labor, immigrant defense coalitions. They took the stance, there's plenty of room for everybody. We should be working together. We should be collaborating. This, in my lifetime, was kind of unprecedented.
And it's really encouraging.
We have to work together. Yeah.
You're seeing it as well on the attacks on academia that, you know, usually, as you just said, Bill Gallegos, that there's all this, you know, interfighting, the sniping from one organization to another, and none of that is present. We're really starting to learn what a united front can be.
Yeah, better to do it now than when we're in the camp.
But this, I think, you know, you began talking about the labor response, which came in reaction to David Huerta's situation, but we also saw, you know, the senator being arrested and
not arrested, but
handcuffed and led out of a hearing with Kirsty Noem, and her pronouncement that, you know, the goal of the administration is to liberate these blue cities from their socialist mayors and governors, as if she doesn't understand what elections are.
Yeah, it's very concerning, you know. So clearly, Susie, they're trying to stack the 2026 elections.
Yeah.
Gerrymandering, cleaning the voter rolls, get rid of mail-in ballots. But I think they're prepared to go to Plan B, invoke the Insurrection Act. So the movement we build now is so critical. And the one thing that we're lacking is strategy.
Yeah.
You know, we have great tactics, great resistance. But what's our strategy? Very conscious and intentional for how we build our forces and weaken theirs. Where are they weak? Where are we strong?
Let me ask you this question before we go into that in a little bit more detail, because you started to talk about, you know, how non-sectarian and broad the resistance is, and that new alliances are emerging. And so I'd like to hear, you know, your notion about them, because I think you describe it as an anti-fascist united front in embryo. And maybe describe a little bit for our listeners what that looks like on the ground.
Well, I think, you know, so of course you have a lot of the left organizations, you know, the Democratic Socialists and others that are really working and advancing a more, you know, once we defeat, what do we want? What's the society we want? So there's this question of substantive democracy, expanding democracy and all of that, which is true. And then there's a lot of forces that are like, they want to go back to the status quo. We have to learn how to work together, because the status quo, to some means, you know, we at least want the protections of Roe v. Wade. We at least want the protections of the Voting Rights Act. We want a National Labor Relations Board that functions. So I think we have to learn how to navigate and negotiate that, that there's going to be a lot of different interests in here. And how do we work that? Even as we are trying to really consciously build up a progressive perspective on what our society should be if we can defeat this right-wing social force. So I think that's important. And there's a lot of discussions about that. And I've heard some people say, well, you know, we don't want to go back to the status quo. Well, in a sense, that's true. But, you know, there's some of that that I think the majority of this anti-fascist front, that's probably where they're at. And so we can't denigrate it.
Not at all. We want to protect equal rights. So we want to protect freedom of speech. That's we want freedom of assembly. All of these constitutional guarantees.
Yeah. A Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment, a lack of search and seizure. There's so many amendments that have been violated that, you know, have to be fought. And in this, I'm very heartened by the role of the ACLU and other legal rights organizations that have come together, Maldef and others. And they were smart.
They started to do it even before the elections. They started to come together, these civil liberties organizations, to say, we better be ready.
So this is all very encouraging. And as, you know, your article states, this is like a template. But now we see, of course, the Trump administration using these same tactics to go into Portland and Chicago. But before we talk to that, let's talk more about, you know, what happened in Los Angeles. And another area of the article is also about the role of culture and the media in this fight.
So there's always been a very vibrant cultural resistance movement, and with any social movement, it's the spiritual side of our struggle. And that really has just flowered even more as this resistance to this right-wing social movement. So when this happened, our poets, our writers, our performance artists, our musicians came together. You know, it wasn't just Tom Morello, who's always out there. You know, that brother's always out there. But it was all, you know, Will.i.am from Black Eyed Peas, you know, Olivia Rodrigo, people that are not in Los Angeles, but, you know, the big names that have spoken out and performed, raised money. But it also gives that sense of that spiritual dimension to what we're doing. So we need the head, we need the heart. And yeah. I think it really gives that part to it. You know, it captures that, the animo of resistance, of our desire for a different kind of world, you know, our vision. So I think that's been a very, very important component of this. And I think we have to see the art and cultural folks as strategic allies.
Absolutely.
The resistance, not just we call them when we need to benefit. They should be seen as strategic allies to any movement we're trying to build.
Well, and as you said in the beginning, that Trump was trying to provoke the Insurrection Act so that he could then, we all know, want to suspend the 2026 midterms, and he's failed on that, but he's still trying, and he's trying very much to foment violence. And I think that was one aspect of what happened in the protests that followed the troops and the Marines being sent here. There were some incidents, but for the most part, people were very disciplined, I thought.
Unbelievable. I mean, you can't help but be angry when you see what they're doing, you know, grabbing children, splitting up families, beating people up. So the anger was justified, but people were incredibly disciplined. Who of us didn't feel like, you know, throwing something at these punks? But folks really understood how important this was, that this is what brings people to the side of our struggle. This is what brings people to, you know, they see that we're willing to make these sacrifices, but they see that we're being thoughtful in our resistance. We're not being dumb in our resistance.
So where do you see the lessons for organizing going forward?
Well, what I would like to see, Susie, is because ICE is still here and they're on a rampage. So our struggle is not over. No. So what I would like to see is some folks withstanding to convene that strategy discussion so we can agree on a strategy going forward. How do we work together in this next phase of the resistance? So that could be the county fed. That could be an organization like the Liberty Hill Foundation, which has a lot of standing with grassroots organizations. You know, that could be some people from academia, progressives from academia. We need a convener that people are going to listen to, but with the serious idea that we're coming together to really try to agree upon a strategy for this upcoming part of our struggle. I'd like to see it on a national level, and there's some of us that are working to try to get that to happen. But I think maybe Los Angeles could be the pioneer in this.
Yeah. Really,
they could say, look, this can happen. We can actually work together. Not just on the immediate, but on the longer term.
It seems like, you know, a no-brainer in a way, because there's universal contempt for what ICE is doing. And now that we see even in Portland, they're attacking people in their 80s and slamming them to the ground, dislocating shoulders of elderly people as they hold them on the ground. You know, and so it's a really ugly scene. And I think it's quite easy to imagine that there's an almost universal agreement that the troops should be out of the cities and the ICE raid should stop. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. So is this a basis, do you think, for creating this kind of front and for moving forward?
I think so. And I think we should pay attention to the troops themselves. So somebody had actually set up a GI hotline. Well, they were here in Los Angeles and they were getting calls. I don't want to be here. What are we doing here? So I think there's so many dimensions to this that we could work on that are really, really important. And that's for the short term and the long term.
Yep.
But I think that's a lesson from the anti-war movement.
As you mentioned, Bill, this convening of a national conversation, essentially, and the beginnings of an organization of resistance, a broad organization that then debates the kind of organizing tactics and overall strategy. How do you see that getting started, or is it already started?
Well, I think in LA, like I said, I think it would be the County Fed and some other, you know, forces with real standing. On the national level, I think we have Reverend Barber, we have AOC and Bernie, you know, we have Dolores Huerta. I think you need folks with some standing and trust. And then it has to be seen as, you know, this is not a brainstorming session. We're here for a very serious purpose to reach agreement on strategy and a commitment to helping carry that out together. And a part of that is going to be, how do we work out differences? How do we handle conflicts that inevitably arise so that we can build this movement in a constructive way? Because, you know, that can tear movements apart. So every movement needs a rumor control center.
Maybe you could just say, what do you think was most decisive in getting the troops out of LA? And what can organizers in other cities learn from this?
Well, I think that we had longstanding organizing going on here in our unions, in our worker centers, in our immigration work rights organizations. They've been fighting these battles for years and fighting for expansive democracy and social justice, environmental justice organizations. So I think, you know, in most places, there's folks that have been fighting the good fight already. So we should turn to them and really, you know, honor them and build off of the foundation. But then I think we really have to, what we did in Los Angeles is everybody's welcome. So yeah, there's things that Gavin Newsom does that we don't agree with at all. But right now, when he's saying these troops out, ICE out, stop the raids, he's our brother. He's our ally. So I think we need to really, and there's still people that have some problems with that. You know, we don't want to work with the liberal Dems and the neoliberal Dems. I get you. You know, some of the building trades folks have been problematic for the environmental justice movement. But right now, we have to really understand where that common ground is.
I want to go into, you know, how Trump used LA as the template for his attacks. But the organizing side of it was also a template from Los Angeles, and you just alluded to it, Bill. But so let's talk a little bit about what this sort of, I don't know if we call it a victory. I guess we call it a victory. We got them out. Yeah. The Marines are gone. There's still troops.
Want to take those troops out.
He didn't want to. So what can, I asked you just earlier what other cities can learn, but let's talk about it a little bit, because Trump used LA as a test and it failed. If he wanted to create a template for authoritarianism, what he got instead was a template for how to defeat it. Yeah. So let's talk about that in terms of the other cities. Pritzker has been mounting a very vocal and robust argument against troops going into Chicago. In Portland, the same thing. How do you see that? And what can, and are people talking to organizers from LA, or is this all just city by city?
That's right. So one of the most progressive unions in the country is the Chicago Teachers Union. Right. And they have been playing a role even before all of this happening for really getting progressives onto the city council. There's DSA members on the city council, progressive mayor, and so on. So there's also longstanding organizations that have been fighting for immigrants' rights, environmental justice. Little Village for Environmental Justice in Chicago has been organizing for years. So there's, again, there's organizations that have been doing this work that are already coming together. They've built relationships with the electeds. So they've already started to create part of that united front. And I think they're now, they're expanding it. That's the part that's going on. So, and I think, you know, there's, we have to give real props to the civil liberties folks, because one of the areas that's given us space is these lawsuits.
Yeah.
These lawsuits are really, really important. And they're winning most of them. Now, we don't know what happens, you know, because a lot of times they just, they win the lawsuits and they say, you know, we don't care. We're going to do it anyway.
Well, that is the problem, right?
Yeah. But that's an important part of this united front is the civil liberties folks. And then I think we really need to make a strong call out to a lot of the mainstream women's movement, because, you know, this attack on immigrants is largely, you know, majority of women.
Right.
Women of color, women from the global south. So I really think this is a chance for those sectors of the women's movement that have stood up from Jump Street against Trump to really throw down.
It's really interesting.
Part of this. And I think it can happen.
I do too. And I think, what you just said is very important because the civil liberties organizations have led the fight on the legal front where they're mostly winning. But as you mentioned, Trump is ignoring it, but he can't completely ignore it. And on the other hand, the arguments, they're providing us with the arguments to fight against, like violation of search and seizure, Fifth Amendment, First Amendment, things that seem obvious, but they give templates. And then all of these organizations are sending out, a checklist of what to do and how to avoid it. And then we're seeing mutual aid. The car wash arrows were telling me that they have a list of all of the workers who are afraid to go out into the street. So they've organized, bringing food to the family, making sure everybody's okay. So it's like, I think overwhelmingly, and you saw it in DC and you see it in Chicago and you see it in Portland, that even though there's all these organizations that are jumping into action, you see this grassroots solidarity building everywhere.
Right. We're not hearing the stories of these folks won't work together with these. We're not hearing that right now. I think we should have started this before the elections, but it's happening now, and that's important, and it needs to be valued and supported. So I think I was proud of what we did in Los Angeles. 5,000 troops, that I don't know if it was a battalion or whatever, but that's a lot. And, they were armed to the teeth. These were not, hillbillies with shotguns. This was armored personnel carriers and helicopters and, the highest tech weaponry.
So, Bill, your article ends with this powerful reminder that unity and solidarity can defeat even a president who's hell-bent on repression. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, we've discussed it, but LA is the counter model, not just for cities, but for movements everywhere. So what is the takeaway that you really want listeners to carry, from our discussion and from this experience?
All right. Well, as a longtime lefty, I want to first shout out to all the folks on the left. Let's work together. Let's come together because we do have a vision. So, sometimes we may have a difference here and there, but we generally want a just, equal society, one that's not rooted in war. So let's come together. I think work together. And then I think, we have to especially connect with folks from the labor movement because of all our social movements, it's still the largest, has enormous resources. It's rooted in communities that are essential to this struggle and be part of the fight back. And then I think, the question of, and this is an important one, the media.
Yeah.
Getting this story out there, and I'm very concerned now about this open attack on progressive media. I think we need a united front of progressive media. I've actually encouraged John Nicholson, The Nation, to convene a conversation with Pacifica and others, about how do we build a real defense against what we know is coming.
Do you have hope that because we were very hopeful after Los Angeles, and it seems, this the Financial Times says Trump is taco. He always chickens out. Are you hopeful that this offensive will be beaten back?
Well, I think so. I'm kind of a terminal optimist. So, yeah, I think so. But I think let's continue to be smart. Our Achilles heel has always been unnecessary division.
Yeah.
So if we can really be smart about finding common ground, handling differences in a constructive way, thinking about non-traditional allies. I was glad when the Chamber of Commerce and the LA Business Council spoke out against the occupation and the ICE raids. It was part of their class interest, but also, that's a good thing. I think if we can find a good way to get this to share, what we're learning here, what we're learning in Chicago, what we're learning in D.C., these lessons are precious. Mm. They're being won through sweat and blood, but oftentimes they get lost because we go on to the next rally, the next demonstration. I think need to be very intentional about how we're building this movement.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, for joining us today and for writing this article. This article is called LA Boots Out Trump's Troops, What Can We Learn? And it's forthcoming in The Nation. Look for it. It's written by Bill Gallegos. And Bill is a longtime Chicano activist. He's working on the Mexico Solidarity Project. He's, of course, in the forefront of almost every struggle and a longtime programmer right here at KPFK.
Thank you, Susie. As my mom used to say, when they introduced Bill's a labor organizer, community organizer, campus organizer, she says, mijo, it sounds like you couldn't hold a job.
You got all the best jobs. Bill, thanks so much for joining us today on the show.
Susie, thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Tom Alter and Bill Gallegos. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, and editor-engineer Juliana Gotha, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening.